Last week, I started with you a study. It's a journey towards Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is a place in the Bible that, you know, we have a lot of nostalgia and a lot of fond memories of. And I want to show you another place in the scriptures where we get a chance to stop and visit in Bethlehem. Unfortunately, today, if you were to visit Bethlehem, you'd find it's mostly a slum. Mostly, it is inhabited by Palestinians, but particularly Christian Palestinians, and they're rejected mostly by the Jews, and they're rejected mostly by the Muslims. And so many of them live in the area of Bethlehem, which is a very small little place. And they struggle to survive, and my prayers are with them. I have a good friend who lives and works and ministers there. And I'm just thinking of him at this time as we go to visit Bethlehem. I mentioned last Sunday that the Lord deposited in my spirit the word firstborn, and the word firstborn just began to capture my heart. And in the New Testament, we will learn that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation. And so we went back last week and we looked at the law of the firstborn. But I want to take you to 1 Samuel. By the way, if you want a copy of these scriptures so you can follow along, just raise your hand. Someone will bring you one of the sheets on the back table there. So you can follow along with me. In Hosea chapter 11, verse number 1, this is not on that sheet of paper, by the way. The prophet said, "When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." Very interesting verse. When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Which is interesting because that's exactly what happened to the nation of Israel. But that's also what happened when Jesus was born and his parents took him to Egypt and they fled. Last week we learned that God brought Israel, his firstborn, out of Egypt with a strong arm, and therefore Jews everywhere are commanded to observe and to celebrate the Passover. With the strong arm, the Lord himself delivered Israel, and they were to go into their blood-adorned house, eat the Passover lamb, and while they were doing so, as they were portraying and fellowshipping around this meal, they didn't realize that what they were doing was actually happening physically. So as they were in their blood-adorned house eating the Passover, the death angel, a demon sent and released by God with authority, that angel passed over their houses and went to Egypt and found any house that did not have blood adorning the house. And every firstborn that of Egypt that did not have the blood, did not celebrate the Passover, every household lost their firstborn. So out of that, then God begins to speak to Israel, and he said, "So I want you to commemorate the Passover yearly, and I want you to remember it this way. Throughout the year, your firstborn flocks belong to me," God says. "You're going to honor me by giving me your firstborn flocks, and so you sacrifice them. And your firstborn sons, you're going to honor me by either putting him into the tribe of Levi, or later on, they could redeem their child with silver. And by that way, they would remember this amazing event. Today, as we follow Israel's long journey to Bethlehem, we hear God give another question. And this question is given out to the prophet Samuel. God says, and if you would back, whoever's back there, I can't see who it is. Hey, put that first slide up for me if you would. And if I forget to put them up, you can put them up too, like you did last week. Thank you so much. Today, as we follow along, I hear the prophet being asked this question of God. And the question is very simply this: how long will you mourn Saul? How long will you mourn for Saul? We're going to talk about that story in just a moment. But the question is, whoa, go back. Right there. That was me. I fat fingered it. Okay. How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing that I have rejected him as king? I said to Judy yesterday, any semblance to a political environment we might be living in is purely coincidental. But I will say this. One time God asked the prophet, he said, you didn't want Saul, and then I gave you Saul, and then I rejected Saul, and now you're grieving, you're mourning him. And he says, how long will you mourn over Saul since I've rejected him? So let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse number 1. Now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing that I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? He didn't reject Saul outright. He rejected him as king. Fill your horn with oil and go down. I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite. So he is sending him to Bethlehem, to the house of Jesse. For I have provided myself, or literally, I have seen for myself a king among his sons. In Jesse's house, God saw a new king. Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me. But the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Then invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me the one that I name to you. So Samuel did what the Lord said and went to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, do you come peaceably? He said, peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And then he consecrated Jesse and his sons, and he invited them to the sacrifice. And so it was that when they came, that they looked at Eliab, or Eliab, and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. I don't know if you get what is happening here, is that Samuel is sent by God to Jesse's house. The elders see him coming and going to Jesse's house, and they're worried, they're trembling because they fear that God may have removed Saul and he was coming to anoint a new king. And the prophet Samuel said, oh no, I've just come to sacrifice. I've just come to sacrifice. So they bring him into the house. He consecrates the house. He consecrates the children, the young men, and he then begins to take the children one by one. I say children because they were young men. He took the young men from the oldest, or the firstborn, Eliab, and said to him, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. I think that if I were Jesse and the others around there, I'd suddenly say, wait a second, something other than what we expected is beginning to happen here. But the Lord said, verse 7, to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as a man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. If I could just stop for 1 second and say, I did a little research, and they estimate that the average woman in her lifetime will spend $250,000 on health and beauty aids in America. And men are not far behind. That's a lot of money to adorn the outside, and I'm not railing against that, but that's a lot of money. Now you know why you're broke all the time. But the point is that not only did God reveal something that is true of Jesse's sons, but he revealed something that is true of just human nature. And that is that we have the tendency to look on the outer person and rarely see past the outer to the inner. But God looks on the heart. He doesn't look on the outer. In fact, they had already got themselves in trouble because Saul, when they found Saul, he was hiding among the saddles and the saddlebags and stuff. And it wasn't because he was humble, it was because he was insecure. But when he stood up, he was, from his shoulders and upward, he was taller than most men's heads. So the average Jewish man beside Saul, from Saul's shoulders, would reach the top of the man's head, and from there upward, he was taller than most of the men. And the people thought, and Saul and God complied with it, that Saul would be a good king, because at this time the kings led the men into battle. Here's a good man. He's head and shoulders taller than anyone else. And, well, for one thing, in the middle of the battle, you could spot him. But I don't know. It could be a little dangerous being head and shoulders taller than everybody else when the arrows are flying. I don't know. But God says of Eliab, the firstborn, now, I know what you see. I know you see that he's firstborn. I know that you see that he's a good-looking man. I know that it makes sense that this young man would be the next one. But that's not how God looks at it. And verse 8, so Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. It's a little bit hard to gauge the English translation. It's the Spirit probably saying to him, no, this is not the chosen one either. Verse number 9, then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. And Jesse made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. And Samuel said to Jesse, are all the young men here? And then Jesse said, there remains yet but the youngest, and there he is, keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes. So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, with bright eyes, and good looking. So the Holy Spirit just begins to identify his outward appearance, right? It didn't say he was tall, though. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is the one. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. What the Scriptures doesn't say is from that day forward, the Spirit lifted off of Saul. So Samuel rose and went to Ramah. Verse 14 says, but the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. Interesting passage, interesting context. You know, if we just go back just for a moment, that on the night of the 10th plague, Israel entered into their houses, and when they came out through the blood, in one night, they became a nation. Then in one act, God split the sea and they went on the other side of the sea. In one act, he covered the sea up and destroyed all of Pharaoh's armies. In one day, God made a nation from Israel. God delivered them through the sea and then into the wilderness. And for 40 years, they wandered in the wilderness. And God would send them prophet guides or judges. And in time, Israel insisted on having a king. They wanted someone to lead them into battle because they were fighting many battles. And God relented and gave them a king. And when he said so, Samuel demanded that God reconsider. He said, don't give them a king because you know how that will turn out. And Samuel, and God says to Samuel, he says, look, Samuel, they've not rejected you. They've rejected me. So give them their king. and then I will tell them what their king will do for them." God relented and gave them a king. Saul was a man just like themselves. He was weak, he was insecure, he was power hungry, and at the end of his life, he was pathetic. I want to believe that the Lord somehow found a way to rescue Saul, but he started fairly well and ended fairly poorly. In a moment of weakness, Saul crossed a line and God rejected him from being the king. He said, "You'll not be king over Israel." The prophet Samuel then begins to grieve again, and he's saying, "God's decision to remove this king is more than I can bear. It's like this was my protege. This was my, I mentored him. I raised him up. I brought him to the Lord, and I brought him into the palace, and I mentored him there. I counseled him there." But history will show that Saul did not listen to Samuel's counsel on so many occasions. And one time, this is what insecure people will do, is they'll cave to the people. And he caved to the people, and he stepped into the role of the priesthood, and he offered a sacrifice because he was afraid that the armies would depart and he would be left alone. And he crossed a line. And in that moment, God rejected him as being king. That happened earlier in the book of Samuel. But now here in 16, God's saying, "Okay, how long will you grieve this man? How long will you hold on to something that I have rejected?" That is going to be something that's going to show up again when Jesus comes. Not that he rejected Moses, but that he had another covenant, which would include even Gentiles. And you could say the same thing again. How long will you hold on? And in fact, God had allowed the temple to be destroyed. We love the Jewish people, Jewish nations, and yet every honest Jewish man knows that his prayers are hindered because there isn't the covering of the temple, which is why he wears, you know, the little kippah. The temple is gone. It's been destroyed, absolutely, totally destroyed. Now their hope is that God will rebuild another temple. But in the meantime, there is no sacrifice, there is no blood, there is no atonement, there's very little hope. And so what it has become is a lot of ritual that is keeping them with their customs and their culture and holding them together till the Messiah comes. In a moment of weakness, God rejected Saul. In a moment of weakness, he could reject any one of us. The thing is, for us to understand that it is very, very important, it's like a life lesson that we need to learn, is that when God steps back from something, you need to now embrace what he has promoted. So what needed to happen was releasing Saul and embracing David. Okay, we're going to look at this story. There we go, right there. All right. So go with me to Bethlehem, to the house of Jesse. And there in Bethlehem, God has seen for himself a king. Interestingly, this is 900 years before Jesus Christ, almost 1,000 years before Jesus Christ. God sent to Bethlehem because he saw a king there. And I think that those words are very intentional by the Holy Spirit, because every time in synagogue when Jews would be reading this passage in Samuel, they would be reminded that when God saw a king, the new king was in Bethlehem. And it should be something that would say, okay, if he did that once, he might do it again. And so you should look to Bethlehem again for another king. So the king that they found in Bethlehem, just like the wise men coming, he didn't look like a king. For one thing, David was not the firstborn. If anything, he was the lastborn. We're not sure how David got forgotten by his dad, but that's never a good sign when your dad says, "Nope, sons are all, oh yeah, there is one more," you know. And actually, we have mused, it's just this, it's just a theory, we have mused. (Clears throat) Here's water. Hope has a name, it's water. Just like that, it stopped. Okay. We have mused in our class that we had on the Psalms that when David repents and he says that he was born in iniquity and in sin his mother conceived him, we questioned, is there a question about his fatherhood? You know, who fathered David actually? Is it possible? Or is he talking about his sin nature? But that would be very, very advance for the Jewish nation to have that kind of insight, but the Spirit of God could have given it to him. We don't know, but somehow Jesse forgot there's a kid in the backyard with the sheep, and, you know, go get him. And David was actually, so in that respect, the last born, which is the very opposite of the firstborn. Firstborn is the son of your strength. The lastborn would be a little less than that. He wasn't tall and strong like Saul. He wasn't a warrior type, and yet he was a warrior. He wasn't wealthy like Saul was, and yet he was wealthy in the spirit. And so this is why God says you can't look at the outward appearance and try to figure out who God has anointed. Let me just tell you that my value system is different than yours. Nobody but God saw in David a king. Nobody could see into his heart and see kingship and nobility there based on his appearance and his assignment. The outer part of a man is what men look at, but God looks deep into the heart. And so, Samuel, when he told Saul that God had rejected him as being king, and Saul grabs a hold of Samuel's garment when Samuel is getting ready to depart, and when he turns, the garment gets torn, and as the garment is torn, then Samuel looks at Saul and says, "So God has torn the kingship away from you." It was a prophetic sign. But in that exchange, he told Saul, he said, "God has sought for himself a man that is after his own heart, and this man will lead his people into battle." So how is God able to say that David is a man after his own heart? I think many of us have struggled with that for a long time. I've looked far and wide. I've studied David. I've studied the Psalms. When you look at what he writes and you see the heart of this man as it comes out time and again, you see that there is weakness in him too. There's insecurity in him as well. And at times he feels abandoned, even as Saul felt abandoned. So why did God reject Saul and look on David? What was in David's heart? And by the way, if God rejected Saul from being king because he disobeyed God, let me ask you, did David disobey God? Oh my gosh, his sins are published in the Bible for everyone to read. Did he commit adultery? Yes. Did he betray his friend? Yes. Did he murder his friend? Yes. Through someone else's hands. Did he deceive his own friends? It goes on and on. His sins are there for everyone to read. And yet God would say, "Oh, I have rejected Saul because he's disobeyed me." And he doesn't reject David. Why? Because of what was in David's heart. I want to know what was in David's heart. If I'm traveling to Bethlehem, if I'm looking for a king, I want to know what we should be finding in a man or woman of God. When I look for a leader, I want to find what God is looking for. I want to just say that this day, on this day, I feel by the Spirit of God, we need to mark it. God is showing the church how to decide on leadership. Biblically, scripturally, spiritually. Before we look at David's heart, we have to look at David's covenant, or the covenant that God made with David. And that will be found in 2 Samuel. So the second book of Samuel, chapter number 7, I believe. There it is. Chapter 7, verse number 1. Now it came to pass when the king was dwelling, David, dwelling in his house. He has now been made king. He has now fought many battles. He has now taken Zion. He has built himself a house, a citadel, a fortress. The Lord had given him rest on all from his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, so Samuel's gone. Now Nathan is a prophet. He said, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar." That means that of the marble house outside, the inside had walls of cedar. "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside a tent of curtains." Then Nathan said to the king, "Go, do what is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." But it happened that night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, "Oops, you misspoke. Let's try that again. Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, would you build a house for me to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the time that I brought the children of Israel up from Egypt, even to this day, but have moved about in a tent and in a tabernacle. Wherever I have moved about with all the children of Israel, have I ever spoken a word to anyone from the tribes of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? God is not a complainer. He is just not. If he wants something, he'll say it. That's just good communication. He never said, build me a house. David is sitting there saying, I feel guilty. I have a nice house. God lives in a tent. Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from following the sheepfold and from following the sheep to be the ruler over my people, over Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone. And I have cut off all of your enemies from before you and have made you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people, Israel, and I will plant them that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Nor shall the sons of wickedness oppress them any more as previously." I should say that the people were in Canaan and they were beginning to inhabit the Canaan, but it started with David's citadel. He set up a capital first, and then they were still fighting battles with Philistines and others to gain land. Verse number 11, "Since the time that I commanded judges to be over you, my people Israel, and have caused you to rest from all your enemies, also the Lord tells you that he will make you a house." You're going to make me a house? Mm-mm. I'm going to make you a house. "When the days are fulfilled, you will rest with your fathers. I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the son of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." This is called the covenant that God made with David. So David's requesting to build a house. God refuses David's offer Instead, God says, I'll build you a house, a dynasty, a legacy, a promise that God would see it, that David's son would rule over Israel all the days of his life. God would see to it that David never lacked a son to sit as king. And there's where the rub comes, because it will be Solomon's sons who will, by their foolishness, divide the kingdom. And in time, the northern kingdoms will go into captivity by the Assyrians. And in time, the southern kingdom would go into captivity by the Babylonians. And then in time, God would bring the southern tribes back into Jerusalem. They would rebuild the wall. They would rebuild the temple. And they would wait for the fulfillment that God made to David of another king. I just want to say, next Sunday, Lord willing, what I want to do is to ask this question. It's found in the Psalms. It's Psalms 89. And I urge you to bring friends and family that are suffering from discouragement, depression, holding on to a promise perhaps. And the question that gets asked, which is very legitimate, you know, today is, how long will you grieve Saul? And next Sunday is going to be a cry from the heart of the psalmist saying, how long, God, will you forget us forever? Because he knew this promise that God would see to it that David's son would become his firstborn, and that Israel would rule in their own land, and they would never lack a Davidic kingdom. They would never lack a descendant of David to sit upon the throne. And by the way, for those of us who've accepted Jesus Christ as our Savior, we say, you know, when you return to Bethlehem, you'll find that God fulfilled that cry by bringing Jesus Christ. His mother was a descendant of David. He is the legitimate king who will rule and will continue to rule. And can I say that the church, in one sense, is looking for the Lord to establish his kingdom on the earth visibly. And yet, as we've been discussing on Wednesday nights, we found that right now the kingdom that God is setting up is in the human heart. God is conquering the human heart, and his kingdom is advancing one heart at a time, one life at a time. And trust me, Jesus will come back. He will come back. So in order to understand David and the promise that God made to David and why God would say that David is a man after his own heart, we have to look at David's descendant. We have to look at Jesus and then kind of reverse engineer it. In John's gospel, we read, it was the time of the Passover, and Jesus went to the temple, and he made a whip, and he drove out all of the temple, from the temple, the money changers and the merchants. And then John records this: his disciples remembered that it was written in Psalm 69, verse 9, zeal for your house will consume me. Psalm 69, 9 says, for zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. What God saw in David's heart that caused him to accept David and reject Saul, even in spite of the sin and the disobedience, was honor. David honored God. Saul feared God, but David honored God. He honored God because, well, we just read it. He's like, God, I live in a house of cedar. I have a palace. You live in a tent. I want to build you a house. It seems wrong to me. Okay, this is the same word, going back to Goliath, Why is this uncircumcised Philistine blaspheming the name of God? Somebody do something. Why is God and his armies, the armies are being sneered at and scoffed at and rejected. You can't criticize the armies of God and not provoke David's heart to say, that is a direct affront on the honor of God. These armies represent him, and they marched into this land in power, and the people trembled before them. As God went with them, they walked carrying the Ark of the Covenant. The people trembled before God, and now the people of God are trembling before one man, even though he is a big guy, big, big, big dude, big warrior. And David is essentially saying in his heart, if no one else will do it, I will do it. I have no idea how I'm going to do it, but all I know is a sling. I know stones, and I can work with that, but I believe that the power of God will meet my honor of God. And so he ran into that battle. It's the same thing that David is feeling here. He's like, it is inappropriate for me to dwell in a palace and God to be neglected in a tent. He wanted to honor God. People in America have lost this, the honor of God. Some people might have the fear of God. They may even have a little bit of respect for God, but the honor for God has been lost in our country. Honoring God, we honor him with our tithe. That's one way you honor him. You honor him with your attendance to his house. You honor him. You honor him by taking care of his house. Even the one, we know that he doesn't live here, but it represents him. We honor him. We dishonor him by not representing his behavior and his heart. The people of God need to hear this today. It's time to honor God. We don't have to honor anything above that. I love this country. I love this Constitution. I may be swearing to uphold it soon, but I will say this, that we have got to honor God even above our Constitution, even above our country, even above our democracy. We're confused about that right now. It was the honor and zeal for God that caused God to say, look, David is not perfect, and I know what he'll do. What a blessing to know that God sees my heart when no one else understands me. What a blessing to know that God sees your heart when you are misunderstood. A little bit scary, but can I just remind you of this, that when God chose David, he knew that David would sin with Bathsheba, Uriah's wife. He knew that he would have Uriah killed. He knew the ugly parts of David's life. And he still chose him. That's no excuse for living a sloppy lifestyle. It's a reason to worship him. It's a reason to honor him. We need to honor his word. I'll never forget my dad. On one occasion, he was so upset because people would not or did not take their ball caps off in the service. That seems like a little thing, except when you've lived through the time of World War II and et cetera, and there was a discussion about honor, honoring soldiers, honoring people, honoring heroes. And then it says, we need to honor God. And so there was, the notion of stamping on our coins, in God we trust, you know. There was this thing about honoring God that came back. So, you know, for my dad, when he looked into a sanctuary and he saw people wearing baseball caps, it was his understanding of 1 Corinthians 7, I think it is, or maybe 11, I forget now, about head coverings and such. But it stirred him. And I looked at that and I thought, well, you know, it's just a very little thing, Dad, you know. And today, I really respect his honor for the house of God. I really respect that things I didn't quite see the way he saw, he still saw them the way he saw them. And it was out of sense of not religiousness, but honor. Zeal for God's house consumed David. Zeal for God's house consumed Jesus. Zeal to kill Goliath because he dishonored God was in the heart of David. Zeal for Jesus to go after the demons behind the warriors. Jesus went after that. A heart after God looks like a heart that is filled with honor and zeal for God. No matter what happened, David always honored God. And no matter what happened, Saul always honored himself. Why embrace what God has rejected? Why mourn over what God has rejected? Why not embrace what God has accepted? It's time to return to Bethlehem, for God has seen himself a king there. In fact, not only is he David's seed, but Jesus Christ is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. I'm going to tell you something in my own life, which is so far from perfect, so far from perfect, that there's times when I just look at certain situations and things that are going on in our world and our culture today, and I just say, okay, that's the world, that's the way and the direction the world is heading. What I'm concerned about is what happens in God's house. What's happening as we go out in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Would you stand with me? One of the things that I'm so grateful for is that, you know, God was not offended that he was living in a tent. It was actually God's idea to be portable from the beginning. He liked to move around with the people, you know. So in the New Testament, we find out that we become the temple of God. So now honor for God also looks like honoring each other. But that's for another day. Father, I thank you so much for this day. And I believe with all my heart that you are calling your people So I got to be honest with you right now, is what I have seen in the spirit is another battle coming. And I believe that it's bigger. It's another wave of something coming from the enemy. And God's looking to raise up his bride as a warrior. She's going to have to know how to fight. She's going to have to be ready. So, God, I'm asking for that. Like, if it's old-fashioned, if we just don't have a name for it currently, I'm asking for that. Whatever the Spirit of God created inside of David that felt like zeal, like one part holy disgust, one part sorrow, grieving, one part backbone rising up and saying in the name of the Lord. One part bending down to heal the broken. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but I know it's deeper than Hallmark. I know that it's deeper than democracy. I know that it's deeper than conservative versus liberal or liberal versus conservative. Or I know it's deeper. We're arguing about the surface and we're not getting to the heart. At the root of this thing, there is something missing in us. And the only thing I can call it right now is honor. Lord, I pray that you baptize your bride in a spirit of honor. Like if we have any sense of gratitude for military heroes, as we should, it would have the same sort of stuff for the people of God who are doing the work of God, for the people of God who are laboring, our missionaries at home and abroad, those who are part of our so-called parachurch ministries, Lord. And actually some of us here today, Lord, who have and are serving you well. Lord, I pray for a spirit of honor to be poured out on the bride of Christ that causes us to look, to stare down Goliaths. And in the name of the Lord, remove obstacles and make way for the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Let there be an honor return to the church. Lord, I'm asking for a day when the church isn't something where people come as consumers to see what they like about it or what they don't like about it, what they can get out of it. Lord, let us come for the honor of God and the glory of God, to serve him, to love him, to worship him. Father, I pray for something to be poured out on us that looks like honor, that looks like zeal, that looks like passion. It might be misunderstood. Okay, I get that. As long as you understand us, Lord. So help us, God.